And Michael Heiser, our guest tonight, we're going to talk about the MJ-12 documents next. Are they authentic? Dr. Carol Chusky is the founder of the Institute for Linguistic Evidence. It's a research organization that validates reliable document authentication techniques and provides assistance to investigators and attorneys in criminal and civil trials where the authorship of any document is questioned or suspicious. And we'll talk with Michael Heiser about her work. Now, Michael, MJ-12, the MJ-12 documents, first of all, Majestic 12, the group of 12, apparently formed during the 1947 period under President Harry Truman. Do we even know if that was true, that group?
Yes, I think we do know that was true. I'll tell you why I am pretty confident that this is the case. There are two documents that sort of get lumped in with the Majestic documents, but one of them is actually more properly placed in the real, definitely real, official documents. There's something that your listeners can see on the majesticdocuments.com website that's created and maintained by Robert and Ryan Wood, something called the Communist Propaganda document. Basically, it dates to 1951, and what's interesting about that document mentions the top secret MJ-12. There's that notation in the document. And that document was released. It was declassified by the CIA in the year 2000. So that is something that, you know, didn't surreptitiously come to a UFO researcher like a lot of the Majestic 12, you know, things we call the Majestic 12 documents. That's a real document. It mentions MJ-12. Same thing for the that notation matches another document, the CIA, what's called the Joya Memo of 1949, also has that file distribution marker of MJ-12. I mean, so there are documents that are sort of outside the loop or can be removed from those that, you know, really sort of live in the land of speculation or live in the land of uncertainty. I mean, especially the propaganda document. It's an official document that was declassified, and there you have MJ-12 in it. So I don't personally doubt that MJ-12 existed as a group.
Why would they call them MJ-12? Majestic 12.
Oh,
of
I don't
course
know.
We know 12 people, but why Majestic?
Yeah. Why does the government pick half the names? Operation this and that.
True.
I don't know why they would pick the name, and I haven't really read any operative theory on it either.
Okay, ironic that it was formed around 47 after the Roswell crash.
Yeah, and I would say whether the alien interpretation of Roswell is correct or, again, my own, again, shared with Nick Redfern most notably, is correct, that what we have, I mean, think about it. If the view that I put forth in The Facade, and again, this is just part of the book, and people can go to alienanswers.com and get the book. But if that view is correct, think about this. Here we have 1947. This is Roswell. This is the place where we have our nuclear technology. World War II has just ended, and here we have this disc, and a disc created with Nazi technology by scientists that we brought over here under the auspices of Operation Paperclip. In some cases, you know, giving them new lives, new dossiers, erasing
a new life, actually.
Yeah, I mean, just making them a new person, in effect, ignoring, in some cases,
their atrocities.
People, yeah, who should have been put in prison or worse. I mean, and experimenting on human beings. I mean, come on, you know, this would have been the most shocking
revelation.
I mean, it merits a cover-up. I mean, if you can use that kind of language, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that if that view is correct, that would have been covered up instantly. And even today, and I want your listeners to ask themselves this question. I mean, granted, I myself would admit that a disclosure, a real disclosure of alien life, it would freak a lot of people out. I will admit that. But I think it's very evident that more and more people today than 50 years ago would be like, oh, well, that's cool. That's interesting. When is it going to be on National Geographic? I mean, it would almost be a sort of a normal thing because, you know, we've sort of been acclimated to it. And the idea has resonance with a significant number of people, that it wouldn't be that big of a deal. And so I have to ask myself, well, can't the government see that? Can't they just sort of let it go that, yeah, you know, there really is extraterrestrial life, and it's not a threat, but we don't know too much about it. I mean, can't they do something fairly innocuous like that? Well, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, maybe they could do that, but I'll tell you what, if under, you know, given the state of the military-industrial complex, and this is not a political statement in any way, just generally, the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about, the idea that we were in cahoots with Nazis to this extent, I think people still, because you still have World War II, you know, personnel living, that would just still cause an uproar. Now, maybe when they're gone, it wouldn't be so much of an issue. But I think the government still might have a reason to not come clean, if that is the explanation.
Right, even though they're trying to come clean on some certain other atrocities.
It's a difficult issue because, I mean, I taught ethics when I was teaching on the undergrad level, and you know, you get into these discussions of human experimentation in general, and well, look at all we learned from this human experimentation. Look at all the good that it does. Look at all the people that, you know, are cured from this, that, and the other thing. And you got to wonder, well, I mean, do we really want to? It's tough. Do we really want to say that it was worth it? That the end justified the means? I mean, come on, you know, it's a really tough, you know, ethical issue, and getting, you know, into that area, especially right after World War II, and even still today we struggle with it. I think that the fact that we still have World War II personnel alive and well in the United States really argues against owning up to something like that, a chapter like that in our history.
Let's talk a little bit about Majestic 12. This is what the Woods believe has happened here. Operation Majestic 12, established by special classified presidential order on September 24th, 1947, mm-hmm. at the recommendation then of Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who, by the way, jumped out of a window mm-hmm. and killed himself or was pushed, who knows. Dr. Vannevar Bush, any relation to the Bush family? Do you know?
You know, I've read both. I'm not completely sure. I tend to think not. President Bush himself, the present President Bush himself, has said there's no relation, so.
You know. Okay. You know, he was the chairman of the Joint Research and Development Board, and according to the Woods, that board and the goal of the group was to exploit everything they could from recovered alien technology. Now, buried, they say, in a super secret, magic eyes only classification that was above top secret were all these so-called documents. How did we find these documents? Was it Stanton Friedman who got them first? How did that all come about?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't Stanton. It was actually prior to them. They came out, started to come out in the early 1980s, and sort of trickled, you know, out for a few years. But you had a number of people involved: William Moore, Jamie Shander. Stanton, of course, is noteworthy for studying them and trying to authenticate some of them. And to his credit, he has uncovered a good half dozen or so that are fakes. In the cache of Majestic documents. And you can go up, your listeners can go up to Stan's website and take a look at his work there. I mean, Friedman is another one of these guys that I think his work really deserves attention.
Yeah.
I look at him, he's tenacious.
I'm on with him and
archive rats. He's just wonderful, you know, for the effort that he puts into things.
I'm with him on the Larry King show tomorrow night.
Oh, okay.
So he's going to be one of those guests. And so these documents, they start showing up. Tell us now how they got to you in terms of what you decided to do with them.
Well, what I decided to do, I actually got the idea for this back in 2005 at the X conference, where I was in a session listening to Ryan Wood, and on one of his PowerPoint slides, he had the word stylometry. And I knew what that was because I'm in biblical studies. Stylometry is essentially the study of a document or a group of documents, a corpus of documents for authorial style. There are stylistic markers. And it goes well beyond things like unique vocabulary. I mean, we're talking about things like how you use conjunctions, words like and, but, and or, how you use the word the, what punctuation patterns do you have? I mean, there's all sorts of things that a stylometrist looks for. And it, I looked at that slide and I thought, boy, that would be a good idea, to apply current advanced linguistic computational methods, because there are people who do this and apply that to the Majestic documents, and they hadn't done it. So I kind of went away and I got busy and I forgot about it. But, 6-7 months ago, I thought, if I'm going to do this, I really need to do it. So what I did was I went to various, internet sources, and the Wood site was one of them. And I just went through the documents, and what I had to establish sort of a selection criteria, because what Dr. Chasky does is something called authorship attribution, and she uses stylometry to do that. But what she needs, and what people like her need, is she needs a document that has a claimed author name on it. And then what we did was, in the documents that were tested, there were
fraud or real, but she needs a name on it.
Right, she needs a name, somebody who claims authorship. And so I had 9 of those, and there were 17 documents. And the 17 documents were chosen on the basis of certain criteria. So the number one criteria, was, does it have a name on it? Number two criteria was, is it at least 2 sentences? Okay, because what the computer programs do is they test prose.
Okay.
So I couldn't have things like outlines and table of contents, and some Majestic documents are just that. So I couldn't really use those. I also wanted documents that had something interesting in them, because I couldn't afford all that could be done. And now that I'm at that juncture.
So you were paying for all this?
Oh yeah, this was out of my own pocket.
Okay.
I didn't have a grant or anything like that, or a donor. And I should say, we really need, those of us who are serious about applying, real methods to research, we need the coast-to-coast audience. And I'll be honest with you, I don't do this for income. I don't need this for income. I have a real job. I have a day job.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fine.
It's a passion for you.
Right. So whatever I do, I want it to be self-funding. I want people to buy the facade. I want them tonight to go up to alienanswers.com and buy the thing. I want people to buy the Majestic document report. Why? Not because I need the income, but I want to turn it back into research. I mean, Dr. Chasky is not cheap, and she shouldn't be cheap, because she's a leader in the field. She's arguably the leader in the field. It was through her work that the whole discipline,
mm-hmm,
of authorship attribution was brought, to the level of legal standards of evidence acceptance in court. If people check out her resume on my site, she's been in dozens of court cases where her work has held up in court. I mean, the week I called her, she said, I'd love to do this, but I'm in a murder trial, so you're going to have to wait a couple weeks. And I mean, she does this thing regularly where her work is scrutinized and it meets the legal standards of evidence. I mean, she was the perfect person to get this done. So she's not cheap at all. And there are a lot of things that could be done. And what I need is, I told the people at Roswell, I said, I need to find about 500 people who care, because Dr. Chasky could do a whole other round of tests. What we have now is basically 90%, rating of validity, that 90%, probability that the conclusions are correct. That can be moved up into 95, 97, 98% territory if we just threw everything at it, everything at these documents that she could do.
Right.
But I had to pick what I could pay for.
Exactly. You had a certain budget that you had to work with.
So, like I said at Roswell, look, if I found 500 people, who cared, who would buy this thing at $11.95, and that's what it is on my website, or people could go to mj12documents.com, if I find 500 people who care, I can just hand her the cash and say, just throw everything you got at it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Leave no stone unturned. And but the flip side is, look, if 500 people don't care, well, then, that tells me something, too.
Right.
You don't really need to spend any more time with it. Do something else. Go off to some other area of UFO research and see what you can do there. So I had to find, documents that had something interesting in there that mentioned ETs, mentioned alien bodies.
Did they all mention that?
No, not all of them do. There are actually very few documents, even in the Majestic corpus, that actually mentions bodies. I mean, people don't tend to realize that, but there aren't that many of them. But I wanted to pick the ones for sure that had an author name and that mentioned something like that. And so what I got was a list of 17. And what I did, I included some of that Stan Friedman had established were fakes, and I didn't tell her.
Were fakes, okay.
Yeah, I didn't tell her because that was sort of my own check and balance on the process. I went into it thinking, okay, I'm going to give her this list. I already know some of them are fakes, that they were not written by the people whose name is
right
on them. And I wanted to see if she could catch them, you know, in the testing. So that's how I approached it. I typed them out by hand. I had a couple people in Roswell help me toward the end as I was trying to do this so I could, you know, have a month of processing
sure.
time and get them ready for Roswell. But I typed them all out by hand. They're simple text files. We weren't concerned with marginal notations or stamps. Or, I mean, the Woods have done all that kind of work, you know, the forensic work on the documents themselves. But I was interested in purely linguistic, stylistic patterns, because when you throw all that in to the software that Dr. Chasky has created, it was part of her doctoral program at Brown University, and she's just kept developing it. When you throw all that material into the computer can detect stylistic patterns, and then you run those patterns against, you know, your unknown. So I not only had to type out the documents that were in question, I had to find, you know, four or five other documents that were already known that nobody disputed, like five letters that FDR wrote, five letters that, you know, Eisenhower wrote.
That you knew.
I had to type all those out, too. So what the procedure was I gave her the knowns. Here are five knowns from FDR. Nobody disputes these. These are real. Crunch those in the computer, get the patterns, and now here are two that claim to be written by FDR. You run those patterns against the unknowns and see what we get. And we did that for nine different authors. So it was a pile of typing, you know, to type out all the notes.
Absolutely. So you don't take you don't take a copy of the real document, scan it into the computer and go that way.
No, it has to be typed word for word.
Okay.
Because it has to be the easiest thing for her to use is a simple TXT file. She can use Word documents, but it has to be something.
So why isn't she looking at signatures and things like that?
Handwriting analysis?
Yeah.
I actually didn't ask her. I don't think she does that.
That's not her. Okay.
She's a statistics, you know, person, but and the Woods have done a little bit with signatures, and so has Stan Friedman. I wanted to break new ground here.
I wonder if all of you are correct, and if you had all of you banded together with, you know, handwriting analysis, with the phraseology, with what Dr. Carroll does, you really might come up with something.
Yes, ultimately what I'd like to do, again, if I can find 500 people who care, is I'd like to again, throw everything at them that can be done. You know, and this is state of the art. This is cutting edge. There is nothing out there that, you know, usurps or preempts Dr. Chasky's work. She's the leader in the field. I was fortunate enough that she would agree to take this on. But throw everything you got at it, get all the patterns, and then I'd like to apply the patterns to documents that don't have authors. And what that would do is you could say, hey, you know what? This document over here that doesn't have a name, Admiral Hillenkoetter wrote that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that has important historical significance, you know, in helping piece together like a timeline or a puzzle or the whole picture.
How long did it take her, Michael, to look at these 12?
It actually took her a couple weeks of processing time, you know, and she actually sent she sent the stuff to some of her colleagues, one of whom I know lives in Greece, and I don't know where the other one lives, but she sent them to different colleagues so that they could run testing, you know, to sort of check herself and then compare notes.
All right, well, let's get some of the results when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. I don't know how people can do this. Hillary Clinton fast blasts me out of New York with a Hillary and Bill loves only me.com email address, so I don't think that's real, but it says, George, love the show. As soon as I'm elected president, I will have the government release all information related to the existence of extraterrestrials. They do exist, as you can clearly see. Jeb Bush is a hybrid reptilian. Oh, gosh. Long live Coast to Coast. Who knows who it is, but they're good writers. We'll be back. Okay, Michael, so it took her a couple of weeks to look at these documents. She sent some of them to friends as well. Give us some of the results.
Well, the results are there were 17 documents, again, 9 authors. And believe it or not, only one of the 17 documents tested can, according to Dr. Chasky's methods, be considered to have been written by the person whose name they bear. So that isn't very good as far as the authorship attribution analysis. What's really strange about them, and for this doesn't translate well to radio, you have to really get a visual on it. So for people who want to see the report, again, go to mj12documents.com. In 8 of the 17 documents appear, this doesn't prove it, I can't be categorical here, but it appears that 8 of the 17 documents may have been produced by the same person, okay, whoever that was.
All right, that doesn't mean fraud, right?
Well, in this case, it's pretty suspicious because here's what happened. You have 9 authors, 17 documents.
Okay.
All of the known, so you have like one known pool, one control group per author. Those stylistic patterns are produced by the software. So you have 9 sets, essentially 9 groups of patterns for 9 different authors. One of those author groups, specifically the one that emerged from the John F. Kennedy document pool, one of those pools, one of those groups of stylistic markers, is the closest match to 8 of the other documents, but not the one written by JFK.
Not the one.
Right. So what it suggests, I was talking to Rich Dolan after my Roswell session on this, and Dolan thought it was kind of alarming, and I tend to agree that he said it really suggests that you had one person producing documents under various names, but that person's stylistic methods, showed through. So you actually have 8 that sort of match up in terms of patterns, even though there's 5-6 different authors represented in those 8 documents. It really looks suspicious.
Okay, so the documents primarily related to UFO activity were authored by the same individual.
It looks 8 of them look like they came from the same hand.
Okay, so maybe that person was assigned to write all the UFO documents, Michael, for the government, for MJ-12.
Well, you'd have to have, here's how it usually went, like a president, again, a high-ranking official would have a secretary.
Right.
And they would orally dictate, Jane, take a letter. They would orally dictate what they wanted in the letter. The secretary would type it out as they dictated or do the shorthand thing. And there you go. Now, authorship attribution, again, stylometry, is a subfield of linguistics, and it's related to a field of linguistics called psycholinguistics, which means the connection of how you speak and write and express yourself with the way your mind works. The fact that a letter is dictated, again, this is just the state of the scholarship here. The fact that a letter is dictated as opposed to written makes no difference. In other words, if I sat down and typed a letter, or if I sat down and dictated a letter to a typist, the same patterns are going to be resident in both letters because both of them come from my head, and I express myself the way I express myself.
Right, and it's difficult for you to change that.
Right, it's habitual. It's ingrained in your mind the way you use words, especially, again, it's things like, how do I use conjunctions? How do I use punctuation? How do I use parts of speech, subject, verb, object? Do I ever invert things? I mean, all these different things that are just impossible, for somebody in a pre-technological world to fake. Now, in a technological world, it would still be next to impossible to fake it, which is why it's really curious that eight of these, even though they have different authors, you know, one, you have Hill and Cotter, you got Eisenhower, you got Twining, all these people who lived at different times, different places, they're different people. They have different linguistic fingerprints, so to speak. And yet, eight of their documents have the same patterns, which is really, again, suspicious. It suggests that someone is producing some of these. And we already knew that going in because of what Stan Friedman did. Stan, again, on his website, had shown that seven of these documents are just out-and-out fakes because somebody took a paragraph or two of one source, changed a few words, put things like magic in there, and then, you know, put a different signature on, and away you go. What I'd like to do, I'd like to take the originals of those and have Dr. Chasky do the same style.
The originals of those fakes.
Yeah, originals of the
fakes. And see if they match up with these.
Yeah, that's one of the things I would.
Yeah,
really
then
like.
You would know the same person authored them, and then you know they're all fake.
And I, without getting how can I say this? I don't want to be accusatory in any way, but I'd also like to get known samples of some of the people who received the Majestic documents and run those. You know, I have no idea what to expect.
All right. At this point, what can you say about the Majestic 12 documents as they relate to UFO activity on this planet?
I can say that the 17 I had tested, and 17 is a small number. A lot of the Majestic documents don't have authors, and we're not able to test them, you know, at least, you know, right now with the current methods, what I was able to pay her to do. So of those 17... 16 of them, you know, are not written by the people who they claim to be written by. One of them is. And so the content of those that did not pass the test, I think it would be fair to say it weakens. It does not eliminate an extraterrestrial possibility for Roswell, but it weakens it. You still have, again, Majestic documents that have no author name, that talk about alien bodies and stuff like that. And they're still there. That's still part of the evidence that needs to be considered.
Here's another ingredient for you. I don't know if you know Clark McClellan, who is a ground-based shuttle fleet astronaut. And he claims, and he's trying to publish a book, he can't get it published. But he, you know how tough that is sometimes.
Yeah.
He claims that he talked to Wernher von Braun years ago. Von Braun told him that he went to Roswell, he looked at the crash debris, he looked at the bodies, and he said they were not of this earth and that the bodies looked like snake skin. And now, whether you believe Clark McClellan or not, that becomes then another story,
right?
But the guy had some pretty darn good credentials.
Right. You know, it's kind of a mixed bag.
And I could see Von Braun going there in 47.
Oh, I could see him going there because there are Majestic documents, again, and there are, you know, other documents that are more official that link Paperclip to specifically the Roswell event, and Von Braun would have been part of that. So I think that's entirely believable that he would have been there. The problem is, even with high-profile people, and again, I'm going to reference Stan Friedman here, you get a guy like Bob Lazar or Colonel Corso, as they put their books out and as they put their material out and their claims out. I mean, people like Friedman and other UFO searchers have found inconsistencies and holes, which doesn't mean that you know, like Colonel Corso's book is just all nonsense. It doesn't mean that, but it casts this sort of pall.
Yeah, but why would a guy like that? He didn't need the money. Why would he lie?
I don't think with somebody like Corso that there's intent to deceive.
No, and I know the co-author because he co-authored my book, Bill Burns, and I don't think Bill's out there to deceive.
No, I think basically we're dealing with interpretive issues across the board. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, there's bound to be somebody out there that just, oh, I'm going to put one over on somebody. You know, that there's going to be somebody like that.
Well, what it does tell you, though, Michael, is something happened. something incredible happened. Now, whether it was extraterrestrial or earthbound, who knows at this point?
Right, and I don't want to become, you know, myopically focused on Roswell, because as I said at the beginning, I don't have any doubt that there was a Majestic 12. I don't have any doubt that the Air Force explanation is just silly. I don't have any doubt that there's this dual paper trail. I mean, something is covered up. I mean, I'm past that point with the whole subject.
Right. You're just trying to get to the scientific end of proof.
I want to know what it is, and it could be more than one thing. You know, the answer, if it ever comes on the other side, it may be three or four things. It doesn't have to be just one thing. But, you know, in my mind, as I talked to Rich Dolan after this, was, you know, boy, you know, we really need to get the extra testing done, because then we can start to whittle away at what really the best, I mean, according to modern scientific methods, what the best pieces of documentary evidence are. Because if they pass, the flip side of this coin is, if it passes state-of-the-art testing, there isn't too much you can do to that. I mean, it is what it is, according to the best analysis available in our scientific world. This is real. I mean, this set of documents is what it looks like it is. And so, you know, to be able to advance, you know, that issue, that question, there is more work that has to be done. Again, Roswell, you know, back to the McClellan thing, I think what we're dealing with is dealing with a lot of people who are going, you know, from memory, and we have interpretive issues. And I'm not willing to say that McClellan or Corso or Burns or any of these people are out to deceive. I don't believe that. I think that you just have to. A lot of it's interpretive. They're telling you the truth. They're telling you what they saw. They're telling you what they think it meant. They're telling you what they think this thing that they saw was, or where it came from. I mean, they're doing their best to say, hey, look, I saw this. This is what I think it is. Deal with it. And that's fair. That's fair for them to do. So the question is not in the telling. The question is in, how is the person who experienced this or who saw this, how are they processing it? What interpretation are they giving it? And that's where all the ambiguity, in my mind, again, because I'm pretty well past the idea that the question of, was there something covered up here or not? I definitely believe there was.
Right, right. The question is, what was it?
To me, the ambiguity is in the processing of what is being said. It's not in the attempt to be straightforward, especially, you know, you got Walter Hout, you know, with an affidavit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's
Jesse Marcel Jr., you know, 71 years old doctor, just came back from Iraq. I mean, he's telling us that his father told him he thinks this stuff was out of this earth, out of this world.
That's an honest statement.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't mean it is out of this world, but it's an honest statement.
Yes.
So, I mean, I know there are other ufologists, especially in the wake of Hout's testimony, that were, you know, how should I say, just dubious of Hout and even the motivation behind it, saying, well, if this was earth-shattering information, then...
Why didn't you say it while he was alive?
Why wouldn't you tell people, why wouldn't you tell the world right away? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good question, but, you know, you never know how someone, you know, it's personal psychology. You know, how somebody's mind works and the process, you know, that
well, you know, he went through a lot during the Roswell issue. As a matter of fact, in his affidavit, they basically assigned him to go home and hide.
Yeah.
And, you know, he probably said, if I come out now while I'm alive and tell everybody what I think I know, I'm going to get inundated. I don't want to have to go through this.
To me, what we need to see, like, let's take Walter Hout. It doesn't matter if Walter Hout's reasoning process is coherent to me. What matters is, was it coherent to him? And in his case, he went through a thought process and said, I'm not going to say anything until X.
Yeah.
And to him, that was a coherent decision. And that's where I leave it. I mean, I'm not going to attribute, you know,
Michael, is
poor
it,
motives to any of these people.
Is it rude of me to have to go up to someone like Clark McClellan, the ground-based shuttle fleet astronaut, and say to him, Let's do a lie detector test, because I've got a great one out here in Los Angeles, and we're going to take care of it. We'll pay for it. But let's do one, and let's find out if you're telling the truth that you talked to Wernher von Braun, and he says he saw the Roswell wreckage, and he says that they were aliens out of this world, that we got reverse technology from it, that they had skin like snakes. Is it rude for me to approach him like that?
You know, I personally, I mean, it's just my opinion, I don't think it would be rude to do that. But I imagine on the other side of it, you're going to have people on both sides that say, oh, lie detector tests are just great. And then the other side's going to say, oh, lie detector tests don't really mean a whole lot because, you know, they've been shown to be wrong or this or that. In other words, I don't know what it would prove, but I don't think it would be rude.
But incredible claims require incredible efforts, I think.
I look at it this way. It would be a thing you could do that if you didn't do it, somebody would ask, why didn't you try that?
Yes. And if the individual in question shies away from it, well, doesn't that tell you something too?
Yeah, that could be revealing too. You know, like I said, it's one of those things that if you can do it, you might as well do it, because if you don't, somebody's going to come up behind you and say, aha, you know, you missed this.
Yeah, he sent me an email a couple days ago. He really doesn't want to talk much until he locks up his publisher. But he's got this incredible story. But, man, I would love to get him on the program. And I'd love to, you know, not any disrespect to him at all, but it sure would make his case easier if he took a lie detector test and passed it.
Yeah. You know, you got, like with Travis, I know you've had Travis Walton.
Yes.
You know, there was a big controversy over the lie detector tests with them. I mean, I don't think either way. I mean, let's say he failed it. To me, so what?
I don't think he did.
Yeah.
He passed it a couple times. I think in Travis Walton's case, something happened to him, and he believes something happened
right.
to him.
And there was one guy, you know, there was the one guy that was part of his work crew that was sort of a shady character, you know, and then they went after him, you know, with the lie detector test ambiguities and all that. To me, a lie detector test is something that you should do, because if you don't, somebody's going to nail you for that.
Yep. I think so, too. Well, let me tell you, give us your websites again, Michael, and what can people do to get your information? And as you said, Facade is coming back out again.
The websites are www.michaelsheiser.com. That's S as in Sam, middle initial, H-E-I-S-E-R. The easier one to go to for the Facade would be alienanswers.com. And for the Majestic Document Testing, MJ12documents.com. You can get there through any of those sites. And again, we really need the Coast audience. I'm just hoping that there are people out there who are interested, who want to support, you know, real research into this. And if not, hey, you know, I walk away. Like I said, I'm not doing this for money. I don't need it for an income, and I'll go off and do something else that's interesting.
So how many people do you need to sign up so you can pay Carol Chasky, the founder of the Linguistics Evidence Company, how many more people do you need to sign up?
If I had 500 people buy the report, it would cover everything I need to do.
That's it.
It's $11.95, yep.
And they just go to your website and they can do it right now.
Yep.
And if people
purchase the Facade, you know, I can take some of the, you know, some of that funding as well. You know, I'm under a new agreement with the publisher, so I don't quite know what that is as far as quantifying it. But I do know with the Majestic Documents, I got a figure for that. I need to find 500 people.
Well, and I'm telling, I know you, Michael, and I'm you know, everybody, he is telling the truth. I mean, he needs the money.
I'm the guy who put income tax forms on the Internet.
Yeah, exactly. He needs the money to pay for this research. You seem obsessed with getting this done, huh, Michael?
Well, I mean, now that it's started, now that it has a life of its own, I want to see some closure.
You might be in too deep to pull out now.
Well, Rich Dolan told me at the Roswell conference, boy, you really stepped in it now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, stay with us because we've got an hour to go of phone calls with you now. Anything you want. You've heard what Michael's talked about all night long. You're next. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.